Welcome to Up to Date. I'm Steve Kraske. This may be one of those conversations that'll have you reaching for the dial in a few seconds, but I hope you hang on because as uncomfortable as this one might be for some folks, it's a conversation worth having. Dr. Jeffrey Peeler is a retired thoracic surgeon from Prairie Village. A couple of weeks ago, he wrote a column for the New York Times that grabbed a whole lot of attention because it's the story of Jeff's decision to build his own coffin. Jeff Peeler has incurable stage 4 prostate cancer, which he learned he had 11 years ago. He's begun the process of, in his words, circling the drain. The coffin, as you will come to see, was a way for him to come to grips with what lies ahead. Dr. Peeler, Jeff, so good to have you here. I'm glad you came in to tell your story.
Thank you very much, Steve. I appreciate being here.
Well, we've done any number of shows on this topic over the years because we think it's important here. In fact, we did one less than a year ago with Ellen Goodman, the Pulitzer Prize-winning columnist, about how she dealt with this issue with her own mother. I guess I get why people don't want to talk about this stuff. So I'm wondering, how often are you making people uncomfortable these days?
Well, I think the coffin building enterprise really tipped things in the negative direction, particularly in my own family when I first brought it up.
Your wife reacted pretty strongly to it.
Yeah, she did. She did. I'd have to say I brought the subject up with all the subtlety of a runaway train, and I should have done a lot better than I had. But I had come to the conclusion that making my own coffin was a very sensible and right thing to do, and it made so much sense to me that I, in my naivete, couldn't imagine that there'd be any kind of resistance to it.
But you had been through the process, at least in your own mind, and maybe your wife wasn't at the same pace with you at that point.
That's certainly fair to say. This is always a journey when a family member is approaching death, and where the whole family in one way or another has to walk the path to acceptance, hopefully. And it's a path where sometimes we're all together and sometimes we're not. But that's just the way it is. This ultimately has brought us even closer, but it did take a while to get there.
That's what you'd hope.
Absolutely, yeah.
So are you making people uncomfortable these days when they bump into you somewhere? Are they, recoiling or not? Or what are you seeing out there?
Well, if I have a chance to talk about it, and I guess that was the reason why I submitted the op-ed to the New York Times, if there's an opening in the dialogue, which I think is just, something that our society categorically needs, then people stop and they say, oh, okay, this isn't just some kind of a morose fixation that I have. This is actually something that fits in the realm of acceptance and actually is a positive motivator to leading a better life.
And yet so many folks look at it as a negative, right?
Absolutely.
You've gone off the deep end. You've given up hope, I guess, in some sense.
For sure. For sure. I've had an extraordinarily good run with my prostate cancer.
11 years now.
Yes. I'm running out of time now. But the name of the game is to kind of stay one step ahead of the wolf at your heels, and I'm totally incurable. This is, short of a wayward step in front of a bus, this is going to kill me. The name of the game is to try new treatments just as soon as the last one starts to fail. And I've had extraordinarily good luck with that.
So what kind of reaction did you get from the column in the New York Times? It was such an arresting kind of piece, this notion of a retired surgeon building his own coffin. What kind of response did you get, Jeff?
The response overwhelmed me and to a large extent made me uncomfortable. I don't do this easily, but I think that there is a message that's very important, and that's why I sent the article in, and that's why I'm here talking to you. But the the responses were overwhelmingly positive. And the interesting thing was that the article struck different people in different ways. Different people saw different things in it. The article, just for the listeners who haven't seen it, and I'm sure there are many, many.
It's on our website, by the way, kcur.org, and just go to the up-to-date page and we'll have it up there. So, yeah.
A significant part of the experience was the friendship that developed between me and my friend Peter, who's an artist who works in wood, who helped me make it. I have zero wood-making skills. And I'm sure over the course of the conversation we'll talk about that a little bit. But part of the article was about an unbelievable friendship which developed. Part of the article was kind of lighthearted. Part of the article was about the meaning of the coffin to me in terms of a gentle reminder of what awaits us all. And interestingly, people responded to each of those facets of the article in different ways. I had one of the sort of the lighter things I stuck in there was you know, when we were making it, we'd joke about, gee, how much nose clearance am I going to need in this thing? And so, you know, someone actually wrote me back and said, "Yeah, our family has a trait of large noses, and so we're all going to laugh about this over dinner together." So, you know, I think that's great.
Yeah, you had one line in there about does the coffin have a lifetime guarantee?
Correct. And we did indeed make T-shirts that said, "I'm dying to show you my next project." So you know, that was part of it. But you know, I also got letters from people that I didn't know, and I'm in the phone book, and that's just the way I am, and I had people writing me from all over the United States, and some of the letters were just, you know, embarrassingly complimentary. Some were funny. Some were from people who had done something similar. A fellow on the East Coast told me that he wanted to build his own coffin, and he bought a kit, so something that could be put together in a couple of hours. And he had a big party on a beach in New Jersey, and he invited all his best friends, and they made the coffin, and they turned it over and put a tablecloth on it and had a picnic.
Wow. Wow.
And then I had someone else who wrote me – this is the absolute opposite. Someone else who wrote me and said that they had stage 4 cancer, and they've been told from one of the best medical institutions in the country that they had – basically a very short horizon, and yet his wife refused to admit that he was even sick. And
wow.
And could I help him with that? So
she was just in denial.
Correct.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
So the responses were, you know, they really ran the gamut. But I'd have to say most of them were embarrassingly complimentary, and it was a little bit like eavesdropping on your own funeral, sort of.
Yeah.
In that sense, it was a privilege to hear what people had to say.
So ultimately, Jeff, you wrote the column. Why?
I thought, well, let me just say this. The building of this of the coffin was never a woodworking project. I came across the idea when I was sitting in the congregation of a horrifically tragic funeral, and
of a young man, I think.
Yes. Yeah. And let me just say at the outset, I am not being remotely critical of what this family had to go through. I mean, they had to say goodbye to a 19-year-old who died of a tragic accidental drug overdose. I mean, and people are just trying to hold themselves together, and any
right.
decision that anyone makes at that time is perfect.
Yeah, yeah.
But I sat there, and I knew that this young man was going to be cremated, and he was sitting in a beautiful mahogany surround and with brass, and I knew that was not going to see the flames. I knew that they wanted to cremate him, so I knew this was kind of sort of a temporary abode for him. And I looked at that and I just said, you know, this is just not me. You know, I'm a guy, I've owned two cars in 28 years. I'm just not, I'm just not into fancy, and it's not a compliment. It's just the way I am.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so I said, you know, I think I can do something that I'm much more comfortable with.
And you wanted to do it because, again, why?
It was a way to open the dialogue, not only to others, but also to myself.
Mm-hmm. You're wrapping your arms around it.
Yeah. You know, I mean, I've lived with the fact that I've had incurable cancer for quite a few years. And we've done various strategies to deal with these metastases that I have to my bones and things. But I don't think that there's ever a time when you say, okay, I'm done. I completely accept what's coming. Everything's perfect, and I don't need to contemplate this anymore. You can get that way for a moment, and I've been that way for a moment. And then my 24-year-old daughter comes in the room and says, "Good morning, Daddy." And then all of a sudden I'm back to point zero because I know I'm never going to walk her down the aisle. And so it is something that needs to be embraced and engaged with again and again and again. And building the coffin was a way to put something in front of me that was a concrete presence that reminded me of that need to have the discussion, both with others, but most especially with myself. And it has really done that.
A concrete presence made of wood.
Absolutely.
How did you decide to build this thing?
Well, even though I spent my life using my hands, I have absolutely no woodworking skills whatsoever. But I do have the great fortune of having a friend, Peter Warren, who is an incredibly skilled artist here in Kansas City, and he works in a lot of media, but he works in wood also.
Yeah.
And Peter and I were friends, but not remotely to the degree that we became as we made this. But I went to Peter and I said, "Peter, how'd you like to build a coffin with me?" And he said, "There was a very long silence, a very long silence." And he was game, under the condition that I got my family's stamp of approval. And I said, "Oh, sure, there's no problem there, Peter. Let's just get the wood selected." And he said, "I think you're overlooking the magnitude of this request."
How difficult was it to get your family to buy into this whole thing?
It was a slow process, actually. My wife and I are absolutely on the same page about my dying. We have daily conversations that begin when I'm not here. And, you know, a lot of them are mundane. You need to know how to reset the VCR. You know, I mean, and that's just life. You know, you mm-hmm. need to know where I keep this or that. A lot of them are incredibly intimate. Are you comfortable with me dying in our bed? And, you know, these are things that a couple who I think are really dealing with the death of one faces, and you know, so I think some do it better than others, but we've always been very, very open about it. And we have sort of protected our children a little bit from this.
You have how many kids?
I have four. Mm-hmm. I have two older boys, 38 and 35, and then a son here who's 26 and a daughter 24. And, you know, when I brought the subject up, I didn't lay the groundwork very well. It was, you know, I'd had a glass of wine and I was with a very good friend and my wife is there. And
you're feeling good maybe for a minute.
Yeah, I was just feeling pretty liberated in thought is the way I phrased it at some point. And I just said, hey, you know, you ought to know what Peter and I are going to start working on. And at that point, I even said, you know, and I think it might be nice if Ben, my youngest son, came on down, or he could help us sand the thing and work on it. And that was just too much too fast.
How long did it take her to sort of, you know, embrace the idea?
I guess I'd say maybe a week or two, but it's been, you know, it's like everything. There's been steps forward, steps back.
And the kids all signed off?
The older boys were, I think it's fair to say, were more accepting. We protected the younger two from this project for a while. Actually, we protected. We thought maybe they're just our, at least our perception of them, and I can explain at some point why we were wrong, in my opinion. But mm-hmm. my perception of them our perception of them was that they were just a little too vulnerable to hear something so sort of in your face about this whole thing. But when when I sent this thing into the Times and it was pretty rapidly accepted, then the jig was up. I mean, we had to explain it to them.
If you're just joining us this morning, you're listening to Up to Date on KCUY. We're visiting with Jeff Peeler, who's a retired surgeon from Prairie Village, who's suffering from stage 4 prostate cancer. He's built his own coffin, and he wrote a column for the New York Times just a couple of weeks ago that received a whole lot of attention. We're having a very frank conversation about all of this. 816-235-2888 is our phone number here. Again, 816-235-2888. Why do we struggle so much with death and dying? Why does it remain this taboo subject in our culture? And is it time to change that? Again, 816-235-2888, our email address, uptodate@kcur.org. You can also tweet us at @KCURUpToDate. So you got started building the coffin, and you wanted to do it a certain way. You wanted to use recycled materials. Tell us how you approached the whole thing, Jeff.
Well, my initial thought, you know, along the line of plane, was I was going to be perfectly happy with grade B builder's plywood. But you don't go to an artist who works in wood with that proposition.
Mm-hmm. And he had other ideas.
He very definitely did. And so he knew exactly what he wanted to do. And so he said, I've got this beautiful old wood. And he pointed at this pile of absolutely dirt and oil encrusted, splintered, just refuse, and said, this will be perfect.
And you thought?
Well, I can be self-depreciating with the best of us, but I thought that maybe was taking it a bit too far.
Yeah.
And
it wasn't Dr. Peeler grade wood, it doesn't
sound
like. Yeah,
this was something, but, you know, he was so right. He said, just you wait. And so, you know, there's a lot of preparation that goes into it. And you know, we started out knowing that this was, as I said, not a woodworking project. We knew that this had more meaning than that. And it all gets driven home when you lay on the floor of his shop on the concrete and you take a pencil and outline your body. Hmm. And then you measure to know how much space you need.
Mm-hmm.
Are your toes going to be pointing down or up? Who knows? And so it becomes very real. But it was still something that we were building. And we took the wood and we... They were 2x6 boards, and we would rip them the long way, and then we would turn them on their side and plane them, and so they would end up book matched, so there would be multiple boards 1.5 inches wide that would make up each side,
mm-hmm.
and then we would glue those together, and then make it's just a straight. Rectangular box. But the important thing for me was we started this thing with the idea that we were building a coffin. And the way it ended up, sort of imperceptibly, was that the coffin was building us.
Hmm. Because you talked a lot during all this.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Conversations about what, Jeff?
You know, we'd build for a while, and we'd have some levity, and then something would sort of tip the scale towards, wow, this is really elemental what we're doing. I mean, this is a statement about the approaching end of my life, and mm-hmm. it's a statement about what awaits all of us. And so, you know, then we'd put down the tools for a while, and we'd just sit with his dog between us. We'd have a beer probably, and we'd talk about, okay, so what do you regret? What do you want to do with your life? What does it mean to have a friend that you know you're going to have to say goodbye to in a short time? And this box, I guess I haven't really said this, but our plan is to, I want to be cremated. I want to be present at my service. I think that's important. I think it's important to everyone to know that a funeral implies a dead body. And because I think that there you need something to bring that home so that acceptance is there. But this box that we made lovingly is going to go into the flames with me in it. I'm mm-hmm. going to be cremated. And Peter, there were a few times where Peter and I stopped and we said, you know, actually more me than Peter, and said, are you at ease with burning this thing up? I mean, we put a lot of time in this thing. I mean, this thing was hand sanded to 220 grit. You know, are you comfortable burning this thing up? And we every time came to the same conclusion, which is absolutely. I mean, this is sort of a surrogate statement for life itself. I mean, this box has a birth, a life, and during its life it's teaching us, and it's going to have a death, just like our friendship, just like everything in life.
You spent how long on it?
Oh, maybe 2 months. But we could have done it faster, but, you know, we'd sort of work on it, and there were some days I'd come down to work on it, and we'd say, let's just play hooky and talk. and so there were days, quite a few days like that.
Yeah. You know, I was going to say, you did something so interesting with this coffin. I want to read something from the New York Times piece, Jeff. You ended the piece this way. So the box now sits at the ready for its final task, when together we'll be consigned to the flames. I find comfort in knowing where my body will lie, and just above it, embossed on the underside of the coffin's lid, in front of my sightless eyes, my favorite line of poetry. I have loved the stars too fondly to be fearful of the night.
Isn't that beautiful?
Beautiful, yeah.
I mean,
it's a showstopper.
It's just absolutely perfect. It's often misattributed to Galileo, but it comes from a poem by an English
Sir Williams, right?
Yes, right, correct.
From the old astronomer to his pupil by
exactly,
Sir Williams.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And you know, and it says different things to different people, but it says to me that if you have embraced life, and if you have lived a good life, if you've loved the stars, then there's nothing that can happen to you that you need to be afraid of.
That's just a wonderful line. Just absolutely magnificent. Okay.
And that's actually I embossed that underneath the lid of the coffin.
Where's the coffin now?
It's down at Peter's shop. And
yeah.
It's just sitting there.
Okay. Let's go to a couple of phone calls here before a break. 816-235-2888. Let's go to Mike from Shawnee. Mike, you're on Up to Date with Dr. Jeff Peeler. Good morning.
Hi, Steve. Hi, Dr. Peeler. Thanks so much. This is such an important issue, and we never talk about it. You know, when a baby is born, it's the blessed event. We have baby showers. We paint the room. We buy gifts and little clothes. And but at the other end, at the death end, and I have some. I'm in my late 60s. I was diagnosed 4 years ago with esophageal cancer, which is a kind of a tough thing to handle. And I'm doing okay now. I just got back from Mayo Clinic a few days ago, and I'm still fine after 4 years. But only cancer patients, I know there are many other diseases, Jeff, but cancer patients who've faced this, I mean, it's easy to say, oh, I know how you feel. Look, until you are that guy.
Yeah.
Well, I'm sorry for your illness, but let me just comment on what you've said so far. I think I absolutely agree with you, and there's something both profound and sad in that as I look at it. The profound part is that what I have learned is, and I feel absolutely categorically at ease with this, is that when we're all born, we're all given a knapsack, and in that knapsack are beautiful things. There's love for parents, love for your fellow man. There's wonder at the world, just perfect, beautiful things. And then as you go through life, you collect things that are considerably less ideal. You collect anger, jealousy, materialism, grudges. And the thing which is absolutely consistent to me, and I think anyone who has sat in the chemotherapy suite looking into the eyes of people receiving what Christopher Hitchens calls the venom sack of chemotherapy. I mean, what a beautiful term.
Mm-hmm. That's mm-hmm.
They look into and they know and they can see that the people in that situation have figured out the complete folly of carrying all those weights in our sack. And they have, as I have, dumped all that out. And the world that awaits us, if we can do that, is absolutely miraculous. Let me just finish by saying that the sad part is that, and people ask me this all the time because I'm very open about what I consider the blessing of having cancer. I would never go back to my life before cancer.
Really?
Absolutely, never.
Because of what you just said?
Yes, yeah.
Wow.
The sad part for me is, you know, people say, oh, gee, do you have to be dying to get to this place? And the sad thing is that in our society, you almost do, but in an existential sense, you absolutely do not. All you have to do is to come to grips with the fact that you're going to die. And the admission into that is pretty cheap. You just have to check that bag at the door.
Mike?
Good for you. Good for you. That's just great. You know, I hadn't thought of making my own coffin, and I don't have to do that for the moment. But I do want to go. I do want to be at my own wake. And I just, you know, I know how that must sound to people. But I'm 68. I've been to dozens of funerals in my life. I've hated all of them for obvious reasons. But I, you know, I'd like to have a wake, and I'd like to go there. And if that's possible someday down the road when I, you know, I'm confronted with that, I hope people don't think that sounds ghoulish. But
and go there in the sense of what, Mike?
Well, I want it to be a celebration. I've had a great life. I've been very fortunate. I've been a lot of places. I've met a lot of cool people. I've done a lot of neat things. When you think of most of the funerals you've been to, they're pretty grim things. And unless you go to a different class of funeral than I go to, and I don't want that to be my final word.
Yeah.
I'd rather go to a party and have people tell stories and jokes and stuff. Anyway.
Mike, I'm sure glad you called, and we'll be thinking about you. We wish you all the best.
Oh, I'll be fine. Hey, thanks, Steve. Thanks, Doc.
Mike, sure appreciate it.
Bye-bye. Thank you.
Bye.
Let's take a break. When we come back, we'll continue our very, very good conversation here with Dr. Jeff Peeler. We'll take your phone calls, too, at 816-235-2888. I'm Steve Kraske of the Kansas City Star, and you're listening to Up to Date on KCUR. This hour, we're visiting with Dr. Jeffrey Peeler. He's a retired surgeon from Prairie Village suffering from stage 4 prostate cancer. He's built his own coffin, and he wrote a column in the New York Times a couple of weeks ago that captured nationwide attention. He's joined me here in the studio. Again, our number, 816-235-2888. Jeff, you're 66, and I'm wondering, what are your symptoms today? I mean, how are you feeling? How are things? Because you look great.
Well, thank you.
Yeah.
I have metastatic disease through all my bones. Pretty much every bone in my body has got cancer in it. And so I do have pain related to that. But it's I don't know. It's just something that I kind of adjusted to for the time being. I know at some point it won't be easily dealt with, but that's where I am now.
You know, you've built the coffin. What else do you want to do? What else is on the list for you?
You know, I have found that, you know, people ask me all the time, how do you deal with this? How do you deal with the fact that you've got a, you know, some people say a death sentence. Well, you know, we all have a death sentence. But
yeah.
How do you deal with a death sentence? Well, you know, I think some people dwell in the past and they find comfort in nostalgic memories. And I have great memories. But I think that if you rely too much on that, it becomes not sort of a safety net, but more of a spider's web. It prevents you from getting to a better place.
Meaning?
Well, I think that you need to give up past memories, and this is a reason why I said I wouldn't go back. I think all of us have an obligation in life to become a better person day by day. I mean, I think that's the one thing that we're assigned
here to do. Yeah,
and you know, I think all of us have starts and stops in that endeavor, but. My experience with cancer has just been a quantum leap in that endeavor, and so I think that if you rely too much on the past, then you don't let yourself free to get to a better place. Similarly, most thoughts about the future are worries, And I've certainly gone through stages of this, and I don't know. At some point, maybe in the next little bit, we can talk about it. But there have been times where I've tried to overplan for the future for my family and things to try to minimize their grief, to try to control the process of my dying,
mm-hmm.
To an extent that probably wasn't healthy, and certainly. Was not efficacious. So things never come out the way you think they're going to, and so the future to me is something to kind of think about, and so that leaves the present. And I don't have a huge bucket list of things to do. I have a burning desire to get the most out of every moment, and. I can, without any hesitation, collapse my life down to the moment of my next breath and be very, very happy with that.
And you've come on the radio. You've never done that before.
I've never done that before. I was absolutely terrified when I came in this room.
How's it going so far for you?
I don't know.
You're doing just great.
Thank you.
Lots of phone calls here for Dr. Jeff Peeler. Let's go to some phone calls here now. Let's go to Mike from Kansas City, Missouri. Mike, you're on with Dr. Peeler. Good morning.
Good morning. How are you all?
Well, thanks. Yeah.
Good. Well, this story really strikes home with me because my father was a physician. few years older than your guest, and he had a liver transplant, and the old liver had cancer, and it eventually spread to his lungs, and it metastasized to his bones as well. And so we, in hearing this, you know, I'm struck by, you know, how my father dealt with it, you know, and unfortunately he was very much bedridden. Once it had metastasized, he really couldn't function very well. But, you know, I live up here, and he and my family's down in Muskogee, Oklahoma, and so I would travel down and see him, but you could see this, you know, kind of change, you know, this kind of sense of peace. And, you know, I'm getting a little emotional, but I just very much appreciate your courage and relate very much.
Mike, I do too. I appreciate that phone call. You know, I mean, Dr. Peeler, would you have chosen the same career, had to do it over again? I mean, one that required you to be away from your family as much as you were away from your family, oftentimes on short notice?
Well, I don't think that I can go back that far to rewrite history. Mm-hmm. You know, at the time that I was going through it, that was the only way for me. You know, I loved what I was doing, but it was interesting. I went through an evolution of that. I did heart surgery for a long time, and that's kind of a technical sort of a woodworking project kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
And
I think that probably qualifies. Yeah.
Yeah. But the last 5 years of my practice, I gave up heart surgery and I did just cancer surgery, mostly lung and esophagus. At KU, and I found that what I enjoy, I certainly enjoyed operating and the feeling of a team coming together and doing something in concert for the mm-hmm. benefit of someone. But I also found that when I was driving home at night, what gave me the most joy was the realization that I'd spoken to some people in the office in anticipation of surgery and taking them from a state of absolute terror into a state of some peace mm. of what was going to be before them and giving them some hope. And so I wouldn't give that up for anything.
Hmm. Now, I was going to say, you know, being a thoracic surgeon, you know, you've seen your share of cancer in other patients so often over the years. I mean, how difficult was it for you to get comfortable with being the patient with cancer?
Well, it's much harder to be a physician, with, in my opinion, with cancer than not.
Because?
You just know too much.
Yeah.
You know too much, and your mind so easily wanders to worst case scenarios. You know, you have the benefit of getting quick results in labs, and you have this surreal experience of having a scan and then hopping off the table and, you know, pulling your pants up and going around to the other side and looking at the scan as it comes up on the computer.
Wow.
You know, I guess that's maybe it's a plus, but on the other hand, having been in the business, when my oncologist comes into the room and there's some bad news to deliver, I can tell by his footsteps. I can tell by how he sits down in the chair. Mm. I just know that he's preparing himself for something that he doesn't really want to say. And of course, there's also the, you know, anytime you get a pain someplace, if, you know, I've got metastases to my skull. Not to my brain, but my skull. But, you know, and then you say you get a pain there, and you say, oh, geez, I hope it's not going to go into my brain, mm-hmm. at least right now. And so you know too much.
Did all this affect the way you've chosen to be treated?
No. I have I made a policy decision very, very early to align myself with people that I had faith in. And it's turned out people that I love. I've had all my treatments at KU, with the exception of recently. I've got a trial drug up in Nebraska, but I have aligned myself with people that I had total faith in, and I've just said, "I'll do what you want." I have not scoured the internet or run around the country or for me, that doesn't work.
Let's go back to some phone calls here. Let's go to Robert from Kansas City, Missouri. Robert, you're on with Dr. Jeff Peeler. Good morning.
Good morning. Thank you for your time. I'll cut to the chase. I'm curious, back to the coffin and the process of building the coffin, what do you think you learned by building the coffin that you wouldn't have learned otherwise?
I'm not sure that I wouldn't have gotten there without it, but the coffin served as a template, both in my mind, in talking to myself, and as a template for talking to others about death. And, you know, people say, well, what are you doing? And, well, I'm making a coffin. Why in the world would you do that? Well, it's because I'm going to die, and I want to be in a place where I'm comfortable. And let me tell you what the coffin has done for me. The coffin has given me a reminder that my time is limited and that I need to make the very most out of every day that's in front of me. And let me say this. On occasion I've overreacted to trying to control my family's grief. And we kept the coffin project from my two younger kids for a while, as I mentioned earlier, mm-hmm. until the article came out. And so with the two younger ones, I came up to them and I said, here, would you like to read what I've been doing down at Peter's shop with my project? And my 26-year-old son was hesitant, and he did not initially want to see it. He was fine hearing about it, but he didn't want to read about it. And I understand that. My daughter, on the other hand, she's 24. She's much more auditory in her processing. And I said to her, I said, Elizabeth, why don't we just find a comfy place and I'll read this to you?
Mm-hmm.
And I read the article to her about the coffin, and she said, well, I've got to think about this. And about 2 days later, she's a calligrapher. She does beautiful calligraphy. About 2 days later, she came up to me and she said, Daddy, I made you something. And she showed me the same quote about I've loved the stars too fondly,
mm-hmm.
that she had done in beautiful calligraphy. And she said, I want to put this in the coffin with you. And she said, I want to give this to you as something which I worked hard on, which I know will bring you joy. And, you know, that is to me an incredible demonstration of acceptance, and it made me feel kind of foolish that I hadn't discussed it with them earlier. And it made me realize that really what acceptance really is accepting and giving love to the people that are around us.
Mm-hmm.
And that's how you get prepared to say goodbye to someone. And I had been preventing her from expressing that. And so that's something that building the coffin gave me that I never would have had if I hadn't done it.
Dr. Jeff Peeler is our guest, again, a retired surgeon from Prairie Village suffering from stage 4 prostate cancer. He's built his own coffin and wrote about it in the New York Times. Let's go back to some calls here. And Mike, good morning. Nice to have you.
Good morning. How are you?
Well, thanks, Mike.
My question is, Dr. Peeler, I am curious, you've basically taken the coffin as maybe not a metaphor for your preparation for death. What other ways have you prepared for the fact that you know you're going to die, and we all know we're going to die, but you just have to have a different timetable? Ours is unknown. So have you prepared spiritually? And I guess part of this is, as I was thinking about what you've done, trying to understand what's the balance between focusing on living and focusing on dying. Because the preparation for death is focusing on dying. I'm sure at the same time you're trying to focus on living. So I'm just curious about how you find the balance there.
Yeah, Mike, thank you.
That's a very, very good question. With regard to the first part, that's fairly easy. I think that everyone should do the obvious things. You should have wills, and you should be sure that bank accounts are titled correctly, and insurance policies are available and in the right place that people can get at them, and those sorts of things. And that's an absolute given. I think at the next level, one would, I think this is a sort of a surgical affliction. I do like to control things. And the next level would be writing an obituary. And I've done that, but I've also told my family they can sort of change or add as they wish. But
you get the record straight.
Yeah, but I think, and let me just say, I think writing your own obituary is an amazing exercise. The hard part is putting it down as it was and not how you wished it had been.
A little embellishment.
Absolutely.
There, right?
It's easy to go that way. Yeah. And there's a little voice that says, no, no, no.
That's so, not exactly how it was.
Exactly. Yeah. I've lined up some people that I want to speak at my service, for example. I dabble in French. And I adore my French teacher. She's going to read the 23rd Psalm in French.
Wow!
I don't care if no one in the room understands it. It will be absolutely beautiful.
Yeah.
So those are all things that one prepares for, and I think that the other question about is one living to die. That's difficult to keep the balance, but I think that this is part of the construction process of the coffin, for example. My friendship with Peter, one of the things that makes us absolutely appreciate each other is we know that it's going to be short-lived. But it's like a daylily, it's going to be short-lived, but you absolutely can be in awe at what you have for when you have it. And that's the way that I try to live. I very clearly go over the line from time to time, as my wife would tell you. It's not a linear journey, and there are times where it's very easy to get bogged down, because if you're going to die, there are absolutely going to be unfulfilled dreams, and I've got dreams like everyone else out there. And giving up dreams is not easy.
The caller also asked about the spiritual aspect of all this. Where are you?
Well, that's I think it's fair to say that in my life I've had a fairly contentious relationship with a greater being. And now I think a place of a little bit more wisdom, I think a lot of that was me being narcissistic and maybe self-centered, that somehow or other my sins were worse than anyone else's, and that that God or whatever would choose to throw daggers at me. But I don't have a need, and let me just say that a very acceptable criticism of any faith that I have is that it's sort of a jailhouse conversion, there are no atheists in foxholes, to throw another metaphor out. But I absolutely do not have a need for a quest for admission to an afterlife. On the other hand, by lightening the load in my pack of all those negatives that I told you about, I see the world in incredibly beautiful technicolor. I see grace in strangers. I see when I walk out in the morning, I hear two cardinals talking, and I say, you know, this is not just random molecules. When anyone who studies anatomy knows that, you know, there's something behind all this. And there's so to me, there is a sense of beauty and trust in the world that I speak to.
Well, that's a good way to end. Thanks so much for the conversation.
Well, thank you for having me. I'm very flattered.
Well, Jeff, we'll be thinking about you, and I'm really glad you came in today. That was a very good way for us to spend an hour.
Thank you very much,
Thanks
Steve.
So much, yeah. Dr. Jeff Pieler, again, is a retired thoracic surgeon from Prairie Village. Tomorrow on the program, last February, a gas explosion rocked the plaza, destroyed JJ's, and left many people injured and one dead. We'll look at the issues that remain 1 year on, plus we'll talk about how to stop violence with science. Our show is produced by Steven Steichman, Danny Alexander, Beth Lipoff, and Cody Newell. I'm Steve Kraske, and you are up to date.